I'm not condoning illegal activities outside of class. But on the other hand, consulting your peers is not illegal. So, and also, I mean, to be honest, though, like the textbook, there's also one called Essential Cell Biology by Albert. If you cannot read this gigantic, you know, 1,000-something page textbook.
Oh, is that big?
It's large. You got heavily discounted, my friend.
I got the scroll down buttons. I never had the time to appreciate how big it was.
Yeah. So,
you sure you got the full copy?
Probably. I didn't have any pages left missing, so.
Okay. The missing pages were viruses. Computer viruses, so easy.
They're low quality.
I see. It's a scanned, isn't it? So anyways, I recommend actually looking at the Essential Cell Biology and also Lotish. That's the sorry, I didn't write it down here, but Lotish's textbook is also very good. Actually, some of it, what I'm using is actually from Lotish also. Not very much, but you know, certain questions and stuff. You know. The other thing is Lotish is very more concise than the Alberts. So the Alberts is kind of, they ramble, you've seen the textbook, right? It kind of rambles, right? It's just like, biology is great, and DNA is our, that's it. And then DNA, they just keep talking about the same thing. So you can also consult Lotish. Okay, so I don't know everybody's here yet, but it's okay. We're going to get started. So today, talking about protein structure and pathways. So before I start, the key thing I want to emphasize today, right? So if this class was in the United States of America, where I grew up and studied this stuff, you memorize every single amino acid down to the molecule, right? Down to the single atom and how they're connected. We're not doing that, but I think you should be aware the different classes of amino acids. This is why I'm doing it first thing in the morning, so that it's the most memorable thing to you. Okay, I know it's going to be the most boring kind of ish part, but to me it's actually a very exciting part, because I can ask all kinds of questions based on these exciting classifications of amino acids. Okay, so, but knowing it also will help your future, because eventually, if you're doing more chemistry or organic chemistry type stuff, you basically memorize it anyways. I memorize it basically anyways, like, without even trying to. Yeah, I mean, I don't remember it now, but at the time, you know, it was very well memorized. Okay, so that's just as a caveat. So let me just talk, you know, because our last chemistry lecture was a little bit short at the end, so this is why I'm going back and discussing some of the more basic stuff right now. Okay, so amino acids, again, is the stuff that makes up proteins. That is the only, you know, you have to know that for the exam. So the general formula of this is basically you have an amino group on one side and you have a carboxyl group. We talked about it briefly last time. Okay, so the COOH and the NH2 groups, right? So one is the acid, one's a base. But, you know, so you have those two groups. And that R that hangs out is called just a side chain. So a side chain is one of 20 different things, right? So, again, like I was saying, the carboxylic group and the NH3 groups are actually ionized, right, at the pH 7, right? So one is acid, one's a base, so therefore they can actually join together. So when you join them together, this is... I'll talk about the joining a little bit later. Let's first talk about the backbone, right? So when you kind of put them together one after another like this, right? So the carboxylic carbon with the next nitrogen of the amino group, you have this CN and then followed by the side chain, and then CN followed by the side chain, CN followed by the side chain, et cetera, right? So these bonds in between, they're the peptide bonds, right? That's where it's, you know, polypeptide. And then the side group hanging out again is whatever you want, basically. And that gives you characteristics of what the protein ultimately is going to be, like function-wise, and also what it three-dimensionally configures into, because that side chain will give you properties like covalent bonding.
Does it have to alternate, like up-down, or the side chain?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we're going to talk about that. Basically, the way, like Viv was saying, the way that you have this carbon nitrogen, you know, it looks like it's kind of, it could have some periodic structure. And basically, actually, depending on that structure, it will actually form into the next step up arrangement. So they're called like alpha helices and beta sheets. But we talk about that. Good question. Yeah. So, but in terms of what characterizes this protein, this polypeptide, you notice that really the backbone is the same. So all you really have to know are the side chains. So in this case, you have this sort of hydro group coming out, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So phenyl group here, sorry, not phenyl, tyrosine group. This is methionine. Sorry, this is the extra carbon here. So this is methionine, this is aspartate. So by the way, like when they say aspartic acid or glutamic acid, that's the same thing as just saying aspartate and glutamate. Just a little naming convention. Okay. Leucine, I'm already teaching you this, right? Leucine, you notice actually is nonpolar. There's no polar groups here. So it's one of the nonpolar groups. And tyrosine. Tyrosine is polar, it's got hydrogen. Okay, so how do you form the peptide bond? So you have this, the carbon on one side with the nitrogen on the next. And when you notice that when you put them together, you have that OH group and H group, right, left over. So what that means is when you dehydrate out the water, you form this covalent bond, right? So this covalent bond is the peptide bond. Through the dehydration, you can form this, right? So you basically, whatever makes these guys, right, which Tom will talk about in translation, is actually going to be forming amino acids together, joining them in this way, putting them in some configuration in which the intermediate state is of them joining is more probable, so that the water comes out and then they form into covalent bonds, right? yeah, so in this particular case, so that we can learn more amino acids, you have this nitrogen-based ring. And the only one that has a nitrogen-based ring is actually histidine. That's important. Okay. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's okay. Yeah. So your T. Hi.
Yeah.
So the I and E endings are for amino acids, right?
Which one?
I and E.
Yeah, that's. I mean, you mean like glutamine, that kind of thing?
Yeah. Ine is only for amino acids, or is that for something else? Maybe a convention question.
Like for instance, is it an
example? One is IME applied, one is, you mentioned in the previous one.
Each
acid can be replaced with an.
No, the only thing that I apply right now is the acid with the 8.
Okay.
Yeah, the ene thing is different. Like glutamine is glutamine.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not. The glutamate is different from glutamine. Yeah, I'm going to show you all of those. I know you're so super desperately interested in
memorization.
To learn all 20 beautiful amino acids, so yeah, it's fun. It's great.
Yeah.
Actually, the way we learn that, you learn the single letter abbreviation, and then you learn the three letter abbreviation, and then you memorize, the name, etc. That's how you learn it. So you guys understand this. You have a histidine, which is the only one with the ring with the nitrogen in it. This is the cysteine group. That's the guys who form disulfide bonds. Valine is a very simple non-polar also, right? It looks a lot like leucine, right? Just one less carbon. See that? That's leucine. That's valine. Giving you unconscious knowledge you're going to use in the future of your chemical and medical careers. Okay, so just to reemphasize, polypeptide backbone, you have a bunch of amino acid side chains coming out. That characterizes the amino acid and therefore the protein. One important thing that I will talk about also a little bit later also, but the bond angle actually is kind of restricted because of the configuration of the backbone and also the side chain itself. So what determines the actual final shape depends on, number one, you have the hydrogen bonding among the side, especially the backbones, right? Those hydrogens then are coming out, sticking out. You have the electrostatic interactions, which, for example, at the ends you have that positive and negative charge with the nitrogen and the oxygen, right, for instance. But, alcohol group, OH group. And then you also have other electrostatic interaction, you know, if you have a side chain that has, you know, that's like acidic, for instance, or basic. Okay. Van der Waals interaction is the stuff we talked about last time, where you have a temporary shift of your molecule so that you have a temporary polar situation, and that attracts other polar and temporarily shifted areas of other proteins. But all these things anyways will determine the final shape of the protein. I keep saying nonpolar. Now you guys kind of realize what I'm talking about. They're basically hydrophobic side chains, right? Because they're just carbon, basically just carbon-based, right? Side chains. It could be ring-like, okay? But it's still, if it's ring-like, it's still carbon-based. But if it's purely carbon-based, it's not going to like water, remember? This is what we talked about last time. And they're going to be hydrophobic. So the examples I gave was leucine and valine last time, and phenylalanine and tryptophan also. Those are also hydrophobic chains.
Like only four, no more?
No, there's more. There's much more. Yeah. Four at a time, you know? We're going to learn four at a time. Yeah. So, and you notice, you know, if you have a hydrophobic chain, right, you're going to sort of cluster inside of a protein more, right? Because you're going to kind of avoid the water wherever you can, right? Yeah. Okay, so, and then you also have polar side chains. So those are the ones, actually, that I want you guys to, you know, at least recognize that they're polar. You don't have to memorize everything, but you should know that, for instance, if you see aspartate, that's going to be, you know, that's an acid, you know. So if it's an acid, what does it like to do? It's a proton donor, remember? So if it's like a proton donor, then, you know, a base is a proton, et cetera, et cetera. You know, kind of sort of simple things, nice things to know. You know, histidine. Anyways, I'll show you the more polar side chains. Yeah. And, of course, the backbone will also interact with other pieces of the protein. So we're going to talk about that. Okay, so first thing about these angles. So this is a little bit complicated. If you don't understand everything here, it's okay. But so here I'm showing you just concentrating on one, one area of this amino acid peptide bond, right? So we focus on where we have this side chain coming out, this alpha carbon. Okay, on the right of it, we're just calling this angle. So this angle that's sticking out of the alpha carbon, psi, and we're calling the other one phi. Okay, I'm just labeling it first. And then when you put that, when you actually go in the lab and measure, you know, organochemistry basically, and what these angles actually look like, right? So you actually go in and figure out that little tiny individual molecule, what those actual angles look like. In sort of peptides in the world, basically the natural peptides that are out there, right? What you see is that you see this type of diversity, okay? So what this means, okay, I'll take you step by step, but what this means is that you have a lot of sort of a clustering of possibilities in which you have a slightly negative, something like a 90 minus 90 degrees or so, a little bit less than 90 degrees, phi angle. So that's this angle with the nitrogen. And then you have different types of psi angles that's possible. You have some that are just below 180 here, and also there's actually kind of a weird cluster here, you know. But for the most part, it's going to cluster around these angles. But what that means is that because of the arrangement of this, right? So this guy is actually a tetrahedral shape. I didn't have time to discuss kind of very precise, you know, organic chemistry of those bonding orbitals and what they look like. We don't have time to do those things. But I can just tell you that basically because of four groups coming out of this alpha carbon, but because they're all different, right? Because the side chains are all different, they're all slightly different angle. This is why it's slightly different angle. If the side chains are all the same, then you're just going to have tetrahedral boom, 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 right? Just like ammonia, basically. Basically. But you have a couple differences. One, you have the side chains could be anything, right, of 20, right? And you have nitrogen and the carbon being slightly different also, right? One being more electronegative, one being more electropositive, right, on the nitrogen. So therefore, these phi and psi angles, when you actually go into the lab and measure what they are, they take these different configurations. And it turns out, right, when you look at these configurations, when you actually, after you come out of the lab and you looked at how you got those proteins, there's actually an additional level of arrangement that's associated with the way the backbone's organized. And that is based on this grouping. So it turns out this phi and psi angle, in which you have a, you know, kind of minus 45 degrees phi angle, along with this, you know, kind of minus 45 psi angle, very kind of repeated structure, is the alpha helix, which we'll talk about later. Don't worry if you don't know yet, it's okay. And then other arrangements give you a beta sheet, and then a different type of helix as well. Yeah, you know, it's not going to make sense by just looking at the angle and figuring, oh, what is that, a helix? So you have to look at what the structures look like.
Speaking of angles,
yeah,
how is a minus 180 degree angle possible?
A 90 is the same as plus 180. It's the same. Minus and plus are just, they're just, you know, because they differ by 360. Mm-hmm. It's just the phase difference, but actually, this, so that's a good question.
I'm trying to understand, like, picture-wise, like, here's your central carbon
yeah.
atom, and, like, back here, what?
It's just on the, kind of, on this side, on the other side, kind of.
So it's actually.
Yeah.
It is on the other side.
Yeah, it's on the other side, but it's not 360, right? So it's kind of like sitting over there. So you have this guy being kind of boom, 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 kind of.
Okay.
You know, I'm sorry, this, I know this is confusing. It's okay. But it's the first thing I show early in the morning. And it's just, you know, it's okay. This is, you don't have to, again, I promise you that you do not have to know this kind of detail. Okay? That you don't have to know. But the cool thing is, though, is that if you do look at these angles and you measure what they are, they're going to ask to give you the prediction of based on of the actual a more complicated arrangement of the protein, of the amino acid backbone. Okay, so we'll talk about the alpha and beta stuff later. Okay, they, that is important. So anyway, people, you can do this. So that's all you have to know for now. We talked about isomers last time, right? Remember structural and enantiomers and things like that. So amino acids, if you look at what they are, you realize they have left and right-handed possibilities, right? Because if you put, basically, if you switch the COO and the NH3 groups, then they're not superimposable anymore. They're actually different. They're mirrors of each other, right? So it turns out in kind of animals and, you know, in this world mostly of living things, you're looking at L-type amino acids. Why that is? That is, yeah, I don't know. That's just evolution, I guess. Why L and not D? I don't know. That really, yeah. Okay. We already talked about this, but I want to emphasize, in addition to, you know, possible electrostatic interactions between different parts of the protein and Van der Waals interaction, that you can have a lot of hydrogen bonding, again, that comes, remember, again, you don't have to have water for this, right? Water does that as well, but as long as you have free oxygen sitting around somewhere and some, you know, hydrogen sitting around, you're going to have already, you know, because the hydrogen is slightly positively charged, polarly, and then you have the oxygen kind of slightly negatively charged, right? You're going to have interactions like this throughout hydrogen bonding, right? Very important hydrogen bonding. Okay, here's the table we're going to memorize, right? So, yeah, again, you don't have to know. Yeah. So here's the easiest way. Here's the easiest way. Okay, there's a mnemonic. First, the thing you should know is aspartate and glutamate, right? Aspartic acid and glutamic acid, right? They're negatively charged because they're acids, right? So those are the two that's easiest to remember. If you see aspartate, ASP, or you see glutamate, glutamic acid, GLU, you don't have to know the single letter. Single letter, no, remember, at all. Okay, single letter for sure, you don't have to know.
But what is it? What's the logic behind DNA?
This is just to make life simpler when people couldn't, you know, didn't have typewriters, you know, they got a single letter code. That you don't have to know. But anyways, negatively charged, because remember, these are acids, so they're absorbing that electron from other guys, right? So that's the easiest, aspartate and glutamate, right? That they're negatively charged, right? So these guys, again, the ones that I'm emphasizing are the ones that are polar, because guess what? If you know which ones are polar, then the other ones are non-polar. That's all it is, right? If you get as far as those two, then it's actually not inconceivable to easily memorize the positively charged ones, okay? The positively charged ones, you have arginine, lysine, and histidine. Now, histidine is easy, because I already told you about it being having that nitrogen group sitting out there. You know, that nitrogen is going to be positive, right? When you see nitrogen, it's going to be positive, most likely. Because remember, in that backbone structure, even, you have that positive nitrogen on one end and COO minus on the other end, right? So you see nitrogen, it's going to be positive. So positively charged, you know, it's going to be histidine. Okay. So these are going to be the basic amino acids. So arginine, lysine, histidine. These are going to be the basic amino acids that are positively charged. Yeah. So you don't worry about acid base. Just negatively charged glutamate, aspartate, positively charged arginine, lysine, histidine. And then the other ones are kind of, you know, you sometimes you remember, sometimes you don't. But, you know, I'll tell you about it, you know, asparagine, glutamine, serine. So you notice they're kind of all kind of, actually, there's nothing. But, they just happen to be all non-charged but polar. Okay, they're non-charged and polar. So anyway, I'll show you like every single formula. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. They have a dipole, and that you just have to look at the formula, and I'll show you. And then the other thing is that whenever you see, so I was saying you how if you know the polar ones, you know the non-polar. Actually, it's easier to not know the non-polar ones. That was tricky, right? Because the non-polar ones are all, as soon as you see them, it's like, oh yeah, these guys are like hydrophobic. Because they have nothing. They have just basically all carbons, right? But they're just different in the way, you know, like the simplest one, for example, is glycine, which is just a hydrogen. Like, you know,
right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, but anyway, so these are all, you know, whenever you see a name like this, right, and whenever you see, like, aniline, glycine, valine, leucine, isoleucine, that's a freebie right there. Leucine and isoleucine, they can't be any different, right? So these are actually just structural isomers, actually. Leucine, isoleucine, just slightly different in the way the carbons are, but the same number, basically the same number. Proline is a good one to use because it's the simplest one with a ring, right? Just a carbon ring, basically. that's also good to know. And then yeah, phenylalanine is also ring. Methionine, you're also going to know, because methionine is actually the start kind of codons. The start, when you make a protein, it's the first one that needs to be there. Right, and that's also not important. Tryptophan, you know, cysteine is also fairly easy to remember because it's the only one with the sulfur, right? So sulfur is still nonpolar, right? Non-charged, makes covalent bonds, but it belongs to the nonpolar group, right? Even with the sulfur. So sulfurs and everything else that has basically carbons only. Tryptophan makes you sleepy. That's okay.
You move on.
Yeah. No, they make you sleepy. Yeah, it's actually the stuff that's one of the reasons you drink milk is it's kind of part of, yeah, I don't know exactly where in the milk, but it makes you kind of a little bit sleepy, and it has kind of basically downstream it becomes kind of, it can get it become a neurotransmitter and then et cetera, et cetera.
So the essential and non-essential ones, are they divided and how are they divided?
Yeah, so that's based on human needs, right? So that's that's all over the place. It's not
okay.
It's not like, oh, only the non-polar is essential. It's not the case.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So that's a different classification. You don't have to know that. Okay. So you have these families, like I said, of amino acids. You have 20 of them. They can be positively charged or negatively charged, right? If you're something eight, you're negatively charged. Okay, that's good to know. Okay, so now we're going to just sort of talk about each of these. It's not going to be full detail, but let's see what time it is. Okay. Yeah, so... okay. So these guys are the positively charged ones, right? So lysine, arginine, and histidine. Like I said, histidine is easy, okay? And also, you're going to see histidine all over the place. It's in the catalytic sites of enzymes and things like that. So you're going to see that. So it has a nitrogen, it has a nitrogen positive. Positive is, you know, very clear. So you're going to see that. So it's the only one that's kind of partially positive at neutral pH. So therefore, it has kind of a affinity to grab an extra hydrogen, so it's to make it positive. Yeah. So arginine and lysine, arginine is the both of them basically have these nitrogen groups that's like out on a not on a ring this time like histidine, but now kind of hanging out. In the case of arginine, you have a double bond here, but in the case of lysine, you don't. But basically, all these guys, the reason that they're positively charged is because of nitrogen, right? So very simply, when you see these guys, these are the ones that have nitrogen out there somewhere. Right? And we'll encounter some of these in the protein function lecture too, kind of enzymes, they're going to need sort of these charged groups to interact with other molecules. Okay, so that's what these guys look like, positively charged basic chains. The acidic chains, again, is the easiest one. That's why I don't even going to show you much. Aspartate and glutamate, And how they become acidic? Again, it's the same, these guys are actually not that different. That's one of the key things. Because guess what? Carboxylic group. What's the carboxylic? That's just the backbone of the amino acid peptide, right? So again, these are not very new things. So that's why I'm pointing out the new stuff, which is histidine, which is a ring. That's kind of the only really new thing there. But with these guys, it's just different number of carbons leading to a carboxylic group, right? Aspartate has one less. Glutamate has one more. Glutamate is actually a neurotransmitter as well. It's actually the most common neurotransmitter in the brain. It's the most positively charged neurotransmitter.
Is there a connection between why the functional group is like ethanoic acid and...
connection with what? Brain?
With it being a neurotransmitter.
Well, yeah, good question. So one thing is that it's common and easy to make, right? I mean, it's, glutamate. If you just for example, MSG, right? The flavoring.
Yes.
That's like shitload of glutamate in there. I mean, it makes you kind of slightly hyper, actually. So, I mean, yeah, it's easy to make. It's kind of all over the place. You know, it's utilized in, and you know, proteins and enzymes and things like that. So yeah, that's one thing, right? And also, you realize this is not a super complicated thing yet, so it's pretty easy to recognize for a receptor still, structurally speaking. So yeah, so those are a couple of things. But why they chose that's hard to know.
And also, like, how do receptors tell the difference between, like, how do they really recognize an additional carbon?
Ah, good question.
It's like, I'm used to, like, lock and key model, like something goes over here, so a protein goes over here and, like, drops down slowly until a click sound is heard. Does the click sound occur when the first chain hits, the second carbon hits? How does it, isn't there a lot of potential for an accidental,
yeah,
too long one to enter?
Very, very good question. So, today, but more next lecture, we're going to talk basically about how the different models. Now, that doesn't completely answer your question in terms of how they're going to interact, but your question basically is, for instance, how do I recognize this aspartate and this glutamate that only has one carbon difference, but at the edges look exactly the same, right? So one thing is it has very, very, very precise geometry. I know it's hard to believe that you can pick up one carbon from that, but the complicated geometry does not just come from that active site. It also comes from the way that the three-dimensional interaction kind of slightly farther away. Because these guys, when you have the extra carbon sticking out, it's going to cause that other protein to stick out a little bit more in the further downstream.
You're saying like a bond angle?
Yeah, yeah. Bond angle part of it, but I mean, this is a very, you know, when you look at this, it's a very curious thing, right? The first thing you think is like, how do they differentiate? But it turns out it's not, basically, yeah, the take-home message is, it's not just a single bond. It's not kind of just picking up that tiny little difference. It's able to kind of, roll over that extra difference into kind of different areas of the backbone and therefore kind of help them to recognize differences. Now, having said that, a lot of receptors are actually going to respond to both.
Okay,
so that's the other thing, right? So a lot of receptors, you know, I don't know too much about aspartate in this case, but other amino acids, you know, side chains that look kind of similar will actually be recognized, right? So neurotransmitters also sometimes, you know, receptors, they're going to recognize, you know, one or the other, right? So they're going to have effects that way too. So your question also, yeah, it's, you know, maybe it's not that important, right, also. Yeah. So it depends. It's just basically, the answer is it depends. If it's a really critical thing and it has to recognize specifically, there are other ways of kind of figuring out exactly where it is. And sometimes it doesn't even care, so, yeah.
So like in the next slide, you have better examples, like leucine and valine, for instance.
Yeah, but here's the thing. These are, yeah, that's a good question too. But these are, guess what? These are hydrophobic, water-hating ones, right?
So it doesn't matter anyway.
Exactly. That's the kind of level of thinking I want you guys to get into, actually. So if you realize what we just said, which is, this is not important, like the way that these are actually configured, then you know what's going on.
What's the one below valine?
Leucine or isoleucine, depending on where you put that extra carbon. So before we move on, does everybody understand that point? So, okay, let me reemphasize that point. These guys are important because exactly what they look like is going to shape that active site, because wherever you put it, it's going to have reactivity, right? These guys and these guys, right? It's going to have reactivity with other groups. But these guys are hydrophobic, so what they're going to contribute is more the geometry, right? Because they're going to interact with each other. They're going to be afraid of water. They're not going to want to be in an active site of an enzyme, which is the things that actually catalyze the reaction that you want, for instance. Now, it's still important, like structurally important. It determines also where they sit, if they're in a membrane, for instance, right? So it's still important, but precisely how many carbons. So in other words, what I'm saying here is that if you had a mutation that changes one of these guys, and these guys don't happen to be in the active site, then it actually may not matter at the end. If it's something that's right on the active site, and this happens also, you have an aniline going into a valine in the active site, that makes a huge difference, actually. So I don't want to say this doesn't make a difference. It could, depending on where you are. So, but for the most part, yeah, I mean, it's more likely that they might not make a difference in terms of exactly what they are. But anyway, again, you don't have to know all these. I mean, it's nice to know something like an aniline, which is pretty simple. It's the second simplest, right? So remember I said glycine was the simplest because it's just a hydrogen right here. Aniline is like the second simplest. But if you know the second simplest, you might know the third simplest, which is valine. You know, just a couple of more carbon. Teasing you guys. It's okay.
Well, if you add one more carbon chain, it becomes leucine.
Yeah, I mean, and then leucine, we just said leucine and isoleucine, you know, so you're good. And then you have proline, which is the only one with a ring, I said, right? I mean, not the only one, the simplest one with a ring, right? And then phenylalanine is just a more complicated ring, right? So it's a phenol in there. You know, tryptophan is a kind of precursor to neurotransmitters. You have a couple extra rings. So this one is actually interesting. This one actually has a nitrogen in it, but because of the ring, because of this extra ring around it, it actually makes it nonpolar. I actually kind of forgot about it. Whoa, that is cool. Yeah, that's so it gives them other properties that you might not.
You like two sulfurs.
Yeah.
There's only one with sulfur.
There's another sulfur, which is methionine. Yeah. Methionine and cysteine are the only ones. I always think of the methionine as the starter one anyway. So these are the nonpolar groups. You see them, you know, they're kind of more or less hydrophobic. Okay. These are the ones that I kind of ignored initially. So remember, these are the ones that are polar, but they're not charged, okay? So I know you're not going to be able to remember all these, but so here you have, for instance, this nitrogen and this carbon that makes them polar, right? Right, because it looks kind of similar to that backbone where you have a polar. That's a polar backbone, right? So glutamine and asparagine, these groups make them polar, even though they're still uncharged. So they're not quite the positive or negatively charged guys that I talked about earlier, but they're also not just the hydrophobic ones. They're basically inert, right? So these guys are polar. They're just not charged quite yet, right? So again, you guys know polar, right? That means there's extra electronegativity in one part of the molecule. So same thing. So the hint actually is that these serine, threonine, and tyrosine, they're all just alcohol groups. There's just different alcohol groups. So really, you just have two different types. One, you have that carboxylic nitrogen thing that basically looks like the ones in the backbone, in the asparagine and the glutamine. These are actually a little bit more reactive, I'd say. And then the other ones are just the alcohol. And alcohols are basically water-like, right, in some sense, right, because it's got that hydrogen there, so therefore it likes to do hydrogen bonding and stuff like that, right? So when you see this, when you see uncharged polar, automatically you go, okay, there's some hydrogen bonding. That's kind of a shortcut. Yeah, because serine, threonine, tyrosine, you all have these OH groups. And OH groups are, by definition, polar. Tyrosine is the only one with a ring. Yeah. Okay. So that's all you have to memorize. No, you don't have to memorize every single one, but if you know more or less the classification, more or less recognize the classification, it's okay.
You mentioned that non-polar ones are more likely to be in the interior part of the container?
Yeah, the hydrophobic ones, right?
They don't really have actinized, like, point.
Exactly. So, but it does depend on the protein. If the protein is sitting in the membrane, then what it wants is wants those hydrophobic groups to sit out to kind of interact with the surrounding nonpolar fatty acids, right? So you're right, but it doesn't. You can't just say that. But it depends on the protein. But all you can really say is the hydrophobic guys don't like water. That's kind of all you can say. So and then it also kind of helps them fold in certain ways, right? But if it's folding in water, then it's going to want to go, you know, like what you were just saying, you know, opposite the water, right? Because if it's folding in the... Actually, this is why the guys who are sitting in the protein, they actually have special kind of more compartmentalization of in terms of when you're making them. And Tom may talk about that, you know, when you're making them in the ER, because you can't just let them fold, like, out in the water. You see what I'm saying? I know, it's a little bit more complicated, but the short answer is you're pretty much right. You're pretty much right. It's you know, because of the water interaction.
For those who pack sulfur, like, they can form sulfur from it. That's also inside the protein or outside.
Yeah, that's kind of a crapshoot. Yeah, sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. So the sulfur is there, but not necessary for the function of them being nonpolar and water-fearing. The reason they are there is that those sulfur guys are going to interact with other sulfur guys that could be way far away, some other place in the protein. And when you join that sulfide bond together, you're linking like different segments of proteins together or different segments of different proteins. Together. Yes. It's hard to say interior. I mean, when you're joining proteins together, it doesn't necessarily mean they have to be in the interior per se. It depends. It doesn't. Yeah, that one you can't really generalize as easily. But the function is basically to join other parts of the protein together. Yeah, it's harder to say whether that's always interior or not. Yeah, I don't think you can say that. Yeah, good questions. Okay, so let me go over the next part. So the way people study this, by the way, they put these proteins in the denaturing agent, for example, urea, and then that kind of allows them to get back to the single chain of these guys, right? Single chain that's loose. And then you can watch them slowly fold back together. It turns out having just the sequence allows you to get the precise shape. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. Now, important thing is that you have actually half proteins that help other proteins fold. These are called chaperones, right? So what they do is they prevent the hydrophobic groups. So remember what we were saying, right? The hydrophobic groups are going to be afraid of water, but they're going to aggregate together. So you don't want premature aggregation. So they make sure that they're kind of well separated enough until they're ready to be folded in the right way. So they make the folding more reliable, makes it, you know, kind of you're getting that folding every time. And also kind of assist the way that the folding actually happens. So chaperones are very important. This is kind of what we were just saying already, the sulfur groups, right? The sulfur groups are going to form kind of farther, longer range covalent bonds that kind of link different parts of the protein together. Okay, so this is the way you have protein folding. You have a long chain, you have that backbone. Basically, the more interior parts are going to more likely have the hydrophobic core, and then you have the outer guys sitting, for example, the serine, the threonines, right? Those alcoholic groups that like to interact with water. that's still uncharged. And the charged guys, right? Aspartates with a negatively charged. Okay. Alright, so, good. This is more or less what it looks like. I'm moving a little bit more quickly, but it's okay. You have different ways of representing these proteins. So, the simplest is just kind of recognize what the backbone shape is. But you can also add in these side chains on this area. And then, this I haven't talked about yet, but I will, basically the next thing, is that this gives you the next level of structure, Don, I haven't taken Will yet. Jesus, okay. We'll get there. Exactly. Beta sheet, alpha helix. I will talk about that soon. And then space-filling model is basically everything. This is what the protein more or less looks like, right, once it's a folded shape. Okay, time to take a roll. Okay, so take a look at these guys. If you don't understand, you know, it's okay if you don't get it yet. It's totally okay. It requires knowing some stuff. I mean, actually, the best thing is that probably if I have that table on there, it would be helpful if I had the table on there, wouldn't it? Oh shit! You guys didn't see that. You guys didn't see that though. Okay. You don't have photographic memory. So let me see if I can put the table. It's hard for me to put the table on this. Well, it's not going to be the same letter as the exam, so you actually have to know it anyway. You know. So, okay. So I know you can't see the table, but it helps a little bit. Okay, so in case, can you not see that?
Of course not.
Okay.
Put them side by side.
It's in your notes.
Put them, only like five of them. Put them side by side. One is the table and the other is the question.
Yeah, but I can't make them that big. Let me see. Okay. Okay.
Can you open up a screen? Do you not have the table in any other place?
Let's see, copy. Anyways, I mean, I think it's okay.
Control N. Thank you.
I think it's okay. Don't rely on the table. Just remember it. It's in your notes, like I said, anyways. Okay? So do the best you can. I'm going to play some music and take a roll. Alright. Here we go. Oh, wait a minute. I need this extra chord thing.
For the music.
This is what you guys are here for the music. There you go. Oh, the music is not working? Are you kidding me?
Your audio jack is on. The green one right in front of your computer. That's the plug.
Wait, is this in the room?
Nice. Alright, work on these guys. I'm taking a roll.
great. There we go. Thank you.
King Show. Give me a second here. Okay. Today's the 13th. Three home. Good. Mark, you here? I'm sorry, that's Mark. Daiki? No, thank you. Is it Yang? I guess Yang. Yang. Yeah. Shen. Shen is here. So Jing Yi. Are you doing it?
helpful.
Well, it's okay. She's not here. It's okay. You guys have to answer when I ask, right?
Late, not here. Late, not here.
Well, we have Rachel?
No.
Okay.
Another one.
Han?
Okay.
Yudina? No Japanese people here. Oh, sorry. Zero. Kion? Jinhee? Christopher? Nick? Not here. Reese is here. Ellen?
No, come on, she came halfway through the class.
It's the policy is when I take a row, I know. This should be the case. But
0.5.
But you're lucky. This time.
0.5.
Yeah, but
it's a
problem.
0.5.
You're just lucky this time. Okay, this is all correct. Everybody's good, right? If you're in, you've got a 1.
That's not
good. Alright.
Oh no, wait, that's a non-charged caller, right?
How long time do we have? Oh, halfway there.
Histidine, that's why.
Okay. Well, very simple. So the first question, right? So what are you looking for? And
positive and negative.
Exactly. You're looking with positive and negative charge.
I know, it's good.
So which one can you like automatically eliminate?
Triple pen.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Those are just polar. You're just looking for positive and negatively charged. Alright, so which one you know is negatively charged? There's only two. Exactly. Alright, so automatically you're down to two of them. Okay, now the question is, of the other one, which one is positively charged? Right. Glutamine is not charged. So therefore the answer is?
Exactly.
Does everybody get that? Everybody got that, right? That was... Yeah. But you know, it's not hard. I mean, you kind of, like I said, you already know it. You kind of, I already told
you. You telling us is not relating to us remembering which one's polar, which one's not polar.
I know, I tricked you into memorizing this shit, right? Okay. Next one's a little bit, you know, again, the next one's a little bit more because you have to, you know, there's more to kind of know it in some sense. But what are you looking for there?
All non-polar, polar.
Exactly. So you want hydrophobic guys, right? So which one? So basically, again, which one can you eliminate?
All but A. That's right. B has F. C has arginine.
Yep.
B has this.
Yep. Yep.
B has like
yep.
B is the only one that doesn't have any holes.
Exactly. Everybody. I'm not thinking that shit. So everybody has some ideas. So basically, you look at the sequence and you go like, wow, I recognize this is positively charged. I recognize this is negatively charged. You might even be able to recognize polar groups. You know, maybe. And that's it. You just eliminate those possibilities. That's all it is. So those are two kind of these two questions are opposite directions in terms of what you know, but it's kind of the same knowledge. So that's the answer, we already told you. Okay. Oh, perfect, the music was over. Okay, I have half an hour to get through this shit. Okay. How long is this? Okay. More than halfway. I mean, left. Okay. So next thing we're going to talk about alpha helices and beta sheets. So these are the next level up in terms of structure. I told you about the primary structure, which is amino acids. The secondary structure is the simplest way in which these chains can form more complicated structures, right? So first, the alpha helix. That's one way to make these guys join together. So they're discovered in like skin and hair. Basically, it's a keratin that's in those guys. And the way that the bond angles are formed, it turns out that you make this helical shape, and you have a turn every 3.6 amino acids, right? So not quite 4, but just like that. And that's due to, again, the chemical connection it has. The end part is the same as other amino acids as well. Anytime you have that carboxylic ending, you have that negatively charged, and then you have the nitrogen part that's positively charged. The membrane proteins that are kind of inside the helix, basically, and they're going to want to kind of hydrobond with each other. And in this case, the outside is actually... So this is kind of, for example, in the protein or in the more aggregate structure, these guys are actually having the outside being hydrophobic more because you have the inside being the side chains. Okay. So I show you... Okay, actually, why don't we go one at a time? So this is what alpha helix looks like, more or less, right? So 5.4 angstroms away, you have these turns, right? So again, the carbon, nitrogen. And these side chains are now going to kind of stick out like this, right? Right. So depending on, I mean, I guess it's not a hard rule, but depending on where that side chain is sticking out, you can either have different arrangements of where the hydrophobic groups are sitting. So I take that back. It's not kind of a hard rule. Although that tends to happen a lot too, where you have the hydrophobic guys on the outside, you know, kind of forming membrane proteins, for example.
So do these form naturally, or do you need a chaperone?
Everything can form naturally, but the chaperone just makes it kind of faster, more reliable. Yeah, so they are, the structure, the sequence should actually give you this. Yeah. Now, the thing that I don't know is whether you can have something that goes from alpha helix to beta sheet. That I don't think can happen, but, you know, I don't know for sure, but. Okay.
Mm-hmm. What keeps the shape is interaction, like this way or up and down.
What happened?
Like, what keeps the shape?
Good question. It's the hydrogen bonding, right? Mm-hmm. So the hydrogen bonding with these guys. So basically, these guys are, you have that extra, you know, sometimes in the side chain, but more in that backbone. When you have those hydrogen and oxygens popping out, they're going to interact with the oxygen and stabilize, basically.
Oh,
right. That's a good question. Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of like DNA, right? It's not the one that's kind of right next door. It's you can see it in this picture. Good. That's a very important point, is that this hydrogen bond is actually forming between this lower hydrogen coming out from the lower nitrogen, and then you go boom, 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 you know, whatever, 3.6 turns away, that next carbon, oxygen, is interacting with it. Yeah, yeah. That's a good question. But it's that, so this is where you kind of, those toys that you play with is very useful, where you actually stack them up and figure out where that hydrogen bond is consecutively, but that backbone actually makes it happen. So mostly it's that backbone, the hydrogen bond with bonding within that backbone allows you to have precisely this shape. Yeah, I know, looks cool. Okay, beta sheet's a little bit different. So beta sheet, you know, it's in silk, for instance. There you have hydrogen bonding between chains, so amongst different chains. So you have the alternation of that side group, left, right, out. Okay, so this is, again, easier to see with a picture. I think it's explaining it does not really help. So there, instead of, so remember the alpha helix, you have this one guy twisting up like this, right, hydrogen bonding within that backbone, you know, 3 or 4 turns away. In the beta sheet, you have the periodic arrangement of these guys. Now, the single chain is not going to get you anything. That thing is not stable enough. If you want to have something solid and stable, you need to have many, many chains together because you have a density factor there, right? You have a bunch of hydrogen bond in that case. So there you have the hydrogen bonding between the different chains, right? The bit different polypeptides, and then that gets you that very rigid structure.
Yes. This is one polypeptide arrangement, one straight line. How does it form different sheets?
Okay, so it depends. So it's possible to have... the most simplest case is what you said. You have one really long polypeptide, they fold back on each other. Now, they can fold back in different ways. They can either fold back parallelly, in other words, where you have that thing going and then coming back and that thing going and that thing going, or you can have it anti-parallel. You go, you come back, you go, you come back, but those guys form within each other. So actually, I was going to talk about that next, but the beta sheet can also form in different ways. You can have parallel arrangements or anti-parallel arrangement, in which you're going one way, coming back the other way, going one way, coming back the other way, but they form interactions in between. And actually, on the edge there, proline actually happens a lot, because you have going there, and then you have that, you know, thing that you need to fit into that turn. So you get a proline, and then you come back. That happens a lot. Yeah. These are all great questions. You guys are asking fantastic questions. I guess that's the next agenda on that. So you can either run in parallel, which is you go, you come back some other place, you go, you come back another place, you go. Or you can be anti-parallel. Anti-parallel is probably a little bit more common in terms of making it like really super stiff and rigid. Because remember, if you have a bunch of these kind of boom, 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 boom arrangements, then you're going to have that sheet being really solid within the core of a protein. That happens a lot, actually, in the kind of core area of the protein that's like flat, nice and solid and rigid. You know, so structural proteins, for instance, right? Cytoskeleton type things. You know. So the next part is a little bit of a complication that I'm not going to go into a lot of details, but you can actually have multiple alpha helices kind of coiled around each other, right? And again, that's just due to the arrangement, more or less of the arrangement of the hydrogen bonding. So in this case, you have a twisting around each other, so each helix is actually slightly kind of turned. It's kind of hard to... You don't have to worry about it, but the point is that you can actually have the alpha helix chains, the helices themselves interact with each other as well. Yeah. Not quite as stable as the beta sheet, I would say. So this is the thing that I was talking about. Which one is parallel, which one is anti-parallel? Exactly. So A is the anti-parallel arrangement. It's going back and forth. Right. And that depends on the primary structure, right? Because it depends on which side chains are popping up. If the side chains that are popping up are all consistently like this way, then you're going to do the parallel, right? So it just depends on where the side chain is. Short answer is. Okay. So this is the extra winding alpha helices I was telling you about. You don't have to know the details, but on the left you see one alpha helix, and then if you coil the two alpha helices together, this is like that snack. What is it called? This twisters. Easy to remember. You can actually have three, actually. It's really cool. So collagen is actually three. In muscle and stuff. It's pretty cool. Yeah. Okay. So first I want to summarize the different types of protein structure. Primary structure is called is basically the sequence of the amino acids. Right? Secondary structure is what I talked about. It's the basic arrangement of your primary chain, which is either alpha helix or beta sheet. Yeah, basically. Tertiary structure is the three-dimensional organization. So how do you get all these secondary structures and primary structure together into some, you know, multi-dimensional, three-dimensional space-filled model, basically. There's actually, turns out, what they call the quaternary structure. Quaternary, that's the word. But that's basically the, when you have multiple chains of peptides and how they interact with each other. So multiple peptide chains forming different domains of subunits. Right? So this is part of it, that when we talk about domains. When we said domains, that's basically the part of a chain that kind of forms into some kind of stable area, some functionally possibly also differentiated thing. Right? So, for example, you have kinases, which are protein, the enzymes that phosphorylate other proteins, other things. Right? So, what I mean by phosphorylation, that just means you add a phosphate group to something to make it active, for instance. Just for example. And that could be like in one domain, right? So, you know, SRC kinase has this SH2 domain. It's just a very characteristic domain that you see in other proteins a lot. And again, you realize there's just infinite amount of possibilities, basically, for different sequences, right? But why is it that we only get a few that's like really stable and actually active? That's evolution. It's selected for just those few. And actually, it's selected for very specific domains and specific themes that kind of keep coming up over and over again. We don't even know sometimes whether it's the most efficient. A lot of times it is, but, you know, because of the way evolution occurred. But it's pretty amazing that you can have such specificities just from the primary sequence. Yeah. Okay, so this is an example of domain. So domain, again, is like functionally or possibly regionally specific kind of area of a protein.
Is this a platonic chain structure or is it just a tertiary
one? Yeah, so the one on the right, this is space filling, so it's like three-dimensional.
The
right?
Tertiary quaternary.
This is, so on the right here is quaternary, right? Because it's kind of different subunits, basically.
So every different single color refers to different.
Exactly.
Separate.
Different chain. Yeah. Different chain. But within that, you have different domains also. So I guess this is something that binds ATP. Here. Yeah. So here we're also looking at a sort of an artist rendering of the secondary structure more here, although it's kind of mixed between secondary and tertiary structure, because you have the alpha helixes kind of folding amongst themselves. And so this is kind of what real proteins actually sort of look like. It's very, it's complicated. I mean, it's, you have the alpha helix, and then it goes into beta sheet. You know, it's not simple, right? And then here you have a beta barrel, which is the beta sheet that happens to kind of into this barrel shape, you know. But that happens a lot. That's in receptors. That's common. That's very common because you have this. You need a barrel kind of shape. Yeah. Okay. So where we are. Okay. Good. I can go a little bit faster, but it's okay. So to a protein diversity, they come again. When you have something we talked about, where you have duplicated mutations, and when you have the duplicated mutations, they form paralogs, right? That's going to become different genes that are kind of slightly different in different ways, but they're still families of proteins, right? So a lot of times when you have different amino acid sequences, you can still have very similar structures because they're going to always form the same kind of beta sheet, alpha helix, right? You change one thing that's kind of downstream somewhere that doesn't matter too much, that's sticking out, you know, that doesn't interact too much with other guys, it doesn't matter. So that's why, you know, even 25% being the same sometimes, you have the same shape. It's pretty amazing that you can have such leeway to do that. The pattern, so So the way nowadays people analyze is actually all computational. So they look at the amino acid sequence computationally, and they can predict based on the database information, based on what we know about how different groups interact, side chains interact, they can say, oh, this is probably what it's going to look like. You know, you let the computer run for, you know, a few minutes and it gives you an answer. It's really cool. A lot of algorithms to do this too. If you guys are computationally interested, I did some of that. It's really interesting. There's, I guess, probably don't have time to talk about detail, but there's these things where you kind of shuffle the domains around to form new proteins, so they're kind of similar looking proteins, but they kind of, you have that one domain being in a different area, that kind of thing. So this is kind of how you get protein diversity, you know, different ways of mixing, matching the same basic structure, basically. Okay, these are just a couple of examples of proteins. I'm going a little bit fast, but it's okay. Yeah, this is an illustration where you have differences in the protein primary structure, meaning you have different sequence between the yeast and the Drosophila, but they actually end up looking pretty similar, right? So the red and the green are, so the green one is the one in the yeast, and then the red is the one in the Drosophila, but you look like these two proteins look pretty similar.
And Drosophila is what again? Plants?
They're flies. Fruit flies. Yeah. So that's why you can study one and kind of be able to infer to others. So these are, we can skip this. We don't have time right now. Yeah, so, it's kind of illustration of points that I've already made. So these are also, so with these guys, I guess one thing to say is like, again, that these different proteins, they look almost the same, but they're not quite the same. But you have a lot of differences in between these two, right? The immunoglobulin and the fibronectin, because they're completely different. You know, one is like some growth factor thing, one is something that recognizes antibodies. But if you look at their structure, they look kind of similar. And that's because it's recycling certain motif, yeah.
What do you mean by module?
Module is kind of like the domain. It's like that one kind of sub-area that does something, you know. It could be part of a chain, of one chain of amino acids, or it could just be, you know, different areas of that protein that all have the same, you know, looking thing, like, you know, people say like the SH2 for the kinases, for example, you know. Yeah. Yeah, so this is the quaternary structure more, right, because you're linking the different chains together, right? So, and the good news with this, so before I can use it, so this material is important, but it's, when you guys study, you're going to concentrate on the first part, because that's the thing. This is kind of illustration of what could, you know, what could actually happen in nature. So the fact that you have diversity in the protein structure, it makes it really easy to adapt to different things, right? So actually it turns out like most of the domains are actually shared amongst all the organisms. It's pretty amazing. So what that means is that the nature is recycling those really characteristic domains, those basic modules, those functional units amongst different proteins even. Right. So in humans, it turns out, this is a shuffling thing I was talking about, you actually have a lot of different shuffling. So in other words, that domain gets shuffled into different genes. Right. So it's really kind of similar looking protein, but with this domain sitting out. And that's actually one of the things that gives it very precise three-dimensional ability to recognize. Right. Because it's just when this domain is the opposite of this domain and it has a positively charged group in there, right? So with functional diversity, you get a lot of specificity. In the binding sites, a lot of times you have these non-covalent interactions, again, with these charged group, for instance, or polar group also. And these interactions actually can also interact with other proteins to make you have these multi-chains. So that's how you kind of join these proteins chains together. You have a lot of repeat elements. Also, for example, in the cytoskeleton, where you have a lot of repeats. So collagen, we kind of already talked about this. Okay, so let me see if we can get to the question. How far are we still? There's still more. Almost there. These are just like artistic renderings of stuff. Yeah, two guys being joined together. I don't have so much comments about stuff you don't need to know. Yeah. Multi-subunit. So what do you think this is, by the way?
Hemoglobin.
Exactly. Good. You guys are good. Because four subunits, you know, that turns out in the middle turns out to be heme group. It has iron in it. It's going to bind oxygen. Good. Very good intuition. So again, the subunits of, so now we're looking at more kind of tertiary quaternary structure, right? So these subunits of the proteins themselves actually can form dimers, for instance, right? So when they assemble together, they can actually, when they're symmetric in the precise way, they can form dimers. And it turns out you can even form these more complicated helical structure. And ring is a little bit harder, but if you have it in this way where the binding sites are at an angle and you can have a repetition of units, you can actually form these interesting structures. But basically that subunit, now you're going to have to be able to form different shapes based on the basic unit. Actin is kind of a famous motor protein, and that's one example of this repetition of the subunit. Yeah. So this is an illustration of the difference between kind of the more structurally more rigid structure on the left with the collagen. I was telling you about how collagen is kind of just it's just alpha helix, but three of them kind of joined together. Collagen, you know, of course, found in muscle and things like that. But so that has more arrangement, but you can also have things in the body, for instance, skin and things like that, where you have more ability to stretch and relax. And there you have these things called the elastic fibers. So elastin, for example, is actually the name of a protein. And that is where you have cross-linking, right? For example, these sulfide bridges that we talked about, linking these different chains together. And there actually, you notice that the property that you want actually is that it's able to become messy and stretch at the same time. So you're asking, like, you know, maybe, like, how can we always get, like, you know, if alpha helix and beta sheet is the only thing we have, how come we just don't get all rigid stuff? Well, this is why, because you have ability of the protein chains to also form kind of more elastic arrangements. Yeah. So you can, like I was saying before, you can have various ways of joining different parts of the protein together. So the one that you should know, disulfide bonds, that forms between the cysteine groups of amino acids, right? And the subunits I kind of talked about already. For example, in the viruses, the cap of the virus, you have this regular arrangement that forms into a geometric shape. You can also have proteins that actually can assemble on its own. It's not so important right now. I need to think of the questions.
Irreversibility.
Huh?
Irreversibility? If something breaks, it doesn't.
Yeah, that one is a little bit so. When you cleave something out, it turns out that it's harder to form it back together, because the idea is that basically the arrangement is formed in such a way that it's kind of maximizing, it's kind of like protein folding. Like, it wants to get to a certain shape. So when you break that, it kind of messes up the way that it naturally is. So therefore, it's kind of, you know, but I didn't talk about it, so it's, yeah, we don't have time to go into the details. But so this is the cysteine groups that can form. You have the interchain. I think this can also form, so the upper one actually. This can also form amongst different chains. So it doesn't really matter, as long as you have that sulfide sticking out and you have something that allows you to, you know, either three-dimensionally makes it favorable to have that, or some protein comes in and makes it happen. Enzyme comes in and makes it happen. So the way you go between the two is oxidation reduction. I know I didn't talk about this, but I will talk about it now. In order to get rid of these disulfide bonds, what you want is you want to reduce, right? You put in the electrons to get in. So what that means is that you want to have a reducing agent if you want to kind of get rid of the bond so that the proteins are sitting in their kind of natural shape. So that you allow them to, for example, in the protein folding case, you actually want some denaturing agent, maybe the reduction agent also, you have disulfide bonds possible to allow them to be in the natural shape. So that's why to get rid of those bonds, you put in the reducing agent, right? Okay, so this is the capsid that I was talking about. This is something that we're not going to talk about. It's okay. Regular arrangement. Yeah, I didn't really talk about this. We kind of already talked about this. So we have 5 minutes or so. I want you guys to look at these questions. It's more important for you to kind of try to see if you can apply what we found so far. That knowing a lot of extra useless shit.
Detergent when used in chemistry? The second question?
Yeah, I mean, detergent is just chemical. I don't know if it necessarily means, but I kind of already gave you the answer, right? If you guys just listen, right? I mean, it's kind of important because if you're in a lab, then you have to know, you know, okay, how do I get in, you know, how do I get that protein into it? Natural state, so I can study it carefully. Right. So I know I didn't give you too much time, but number two is okay, right? Because I kind of just told you. So basically, again, I tell you why that is. You don't want to memorize it, right? So it's because you want to put in the electrons to kind of separate that sulfide bridges out. So in order to do that, it's a reducing agent that you put it in. And then what you get out actually is you only just get multiple chains. That doesn't mean you're denaturing them. It doesn't mean you're getting down to the single amino acid level. So in other words, you can still have folded shapes of proteins like that's like this, for example, even in a single chain. It's just that you're separating them out that, so that you can look at single domains modules possibly using like a technique like X-ray crystallography or something, yeah, to look at the structure. Okay, now the first one, how do you do this question?
Process elimination.
Exactly. This is every single question almost in this exam is process of elimination. Which one you guys know for sure is wrong?
All of the above.
Because at least one is wrong. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. If you know one of it, at least one is wrong, you obviously eliminate the last one. So it's very.
As only a few specific amino acid sequences can develop these repetitive structures. No.
Yeah, give me a reason. So let's.
Like you just mentioned, it only takes 25% of the original group, amino acid configuration,
exactly,
to result in the same structure protein. That means a lot of vague amino acid sequences can adopt these structures.
Yeah, for example, you switch one of the nonpolar groups to some other very similar leucine for isoleucine. I don't know. but actually, there are diseases where that happens. You switch a leucine for isoleucine, bam. But yeah, depends on where you are. Depends on where you are. So yeah, that's right. So what about hydrogen bonding between amino acid side chains to find the type of secondary structure?
Sounds right.
No,
it's not
side chain.
Oh, it's main backbone.
Good job. Good. Very good. Linguistic. Yeah. It's the backbone, exactly. So, what about B? Why is B? Well, okay. I don't know.
That's short.
What about B? What about B?
That's certain short amino acid sequence. It depends on the chaperone proteins that can mold in shape.
That doesn't necessarily. The chaperone doesn't necessarily. Yeah, determine that. It kind of, the chaperone really only just helps the process along. It doesn't mean that, you know, so everything you know is from the sequence. The sequence gives you everything. But that sequence,
there's always a dot, like there's probably some way to change the structure.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically the right point. But basically, the amino acid sequence, right, even though you could, you know, like, so it sounds like it should be always the same thing, but it turns out in the real world it's not, just because, you know, when you have a small sequence in between certain elements, for example, there's different things you can do. I mean, there's we were already talking about that triple helices and alpha helices. Well, why do you have one? Well, that you can't. That depends on the whole protein. It doesn't necessarily mean one sequence always going to do exactly the same thing every time. And even that parallel versus anti-parallel thing, it's not always, you know, sometimes you can just rip it apart and put it back together the other way. Because think about it. Parallel and anti-parallel assumes that you're saying the side chains are different. When the side chains are exactly the same, that's exactly the same arrangement. Almost. I mean, there's an extra group, but that extra group could be anything. I mean, it's a little, yeah.
What does short,
why
do you say short? Like a certain short
element. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I change it. Yeah. Anyway, so now you know the answer. So again, there's no class on. Perfect timing. No class on, right, so there's no class next Tuesday. I want to emphasize, no class next Tuesday, but there's an extra class on the 31st, okay? Yeah. And because everybody said it was okay that they can make it, it is required. You do have to come to that class. You do get credit for coming to that class. And you do get exam questions revealed at that class. And again, for those of you who missed it, exam is going to be 40 to 50 questions, multiple choice.